And actually, we still have to do a consistency check that we actually got a consistent picture. And so you guys should now know what this consistency check is. actually, I wrote it there. So let's try to see what we did yesterday. We basically said, I mean, we have actually two pictures. One, you could say, is a space-time picture. the other is phase space, which of course, you know, it's much higher dimensional than I could draw here. It's infinite dimensional. Space-time is also usually slightly higher dimensional than I can draw here. and so, as is usual in physics, I mean, phase space just means that you want to find the parametrization of your solution. So assume you have a solution. Then this solution basically induces initial values on your hypersurface. And so in our case, it turns out that these initial values just, you know, they are given, you can take the phase space variables there, so they would be the spatial pullback of your connection and these electric fluxes. okay, and so these initial values indeed correspond to one point in our phase space. And then there was basically the claim that, in fact, the constraints which we found, yeah, so actually we found some constraints. So these are actually necessarily satisfied if you actually find these initial values, which come from a solution, then these initial values, these phase space variables, indeed satisfy automatically the constraints, because these constraints we found are nothing else than part of the equation of motion. So these satisfy the constraints. So that means that actually this phase space point is on a constrained hypersurface, which is again higher dimensional than this one dimensional thing I can draw here. And now I get into some dimensional problems. So that's a constrained hypersurface and phase space. And then we said that the constraints also generate a flow which we can identify here as a evolution in time. So that means that depending on my Lagrange parameters which I choose, so I can basically choose for these constraints arbitrary coefficients, I might get a different hypersurface here. So that looks a bit bad, but if I choose something negative, then it can also happen that I go backwards in time and so on. So this is sigma 2. And so in fact, in phase space, it would be mapped to another point, which is necessarily on this constrained hypersurface. And choosing any choice here of these parameters, which you can also call lapse and shift. Also, lapse and shift are not exactly the parameters in front of the flatness constraints and the rotation constraints. You get basically an orbit in phase space. And actually, the entire gauge orbit in phase space would correspond to allowing completely arbitrary looking for all possibilities of choosing these gauge parameters here, then you get the so-called gauge orbit associated to a point. And as you see, these gauge orbits, they would, in this interpretation, just correspond to different slices of the hypersurface, different choices of the framings, and possibly redefinitions of this hypersurface in itself. So that means diffeomorphisms just on this hypersurface. But they would all lead to the same solution. And that's why later on we basically would identify and define that one gauge orbit, you know, corresponds to one physical solution. So we call it just one physical state. But to get to the constraint algebra, we basically said that I made here a claim which we didn't actually have verified. And this claim is actually that this point is necessarily on the constrained hypersurface. And so we haven't checked this. And so the question is, what do we need to check to see that? So basically, we said that if you want to know what is the time evolution of E or A, we need to E dot or A dot, we would need to take the Poisson brackets with the Hamiltonian, and the Hamiltonian is a combination of these smeared constraints. However, what we need to know is that actually this time evolved data still satisfies the constraints. So what would we need to check? Yeah. So it's that the constraints themselves satisfy an algebra, namely that actually something, if I take this time evolution, and then I would basically have to check what I want to have is that I need to write dot prime. So I take a time evolution now of this Hamiltonian. So let's take any Hamiltonian H prime, which means prime means possibly different Lagrange multipliers. So I would need that the time evolution of any such Hamiltonian or of any such constraint again would give me that this is that the time evolution does not leave the constrained hypersurface, and that would mean that it is actually zero. However, that is actually not necessary. What I actually need is that this time evolution gives me zero on the constrained hypersurface. So that means that the constrained hypersurface is preserved under time evolution. Because if I'm not on the constrained hypersurface, I'm not considering a solution and I don't actually care about what happens there. So I need basically this to be satisfied only on the constrained hypersurface. However, that means if I write now more properly things with a smeared constraint, that what one would need here is that on the right hand side.
Sorry, question. Is that the same as discussion for only a Hamiltonian which contains just the constraints?
Yeah, so it's, this is now for a totally constrained system. So H is here, H always means combination of constraints. So here I want to have, again, a combination of constraints. And since in my notation H is you know, I can write any H. H just stands for this combination of constraints. It means that on the right-hand side, I need, again, a constraint with possibly different Lagrange multipliers and prime prime. And in awful cases, it can actually happen that these n prime prime depend on phase space. And if it doesn't depend on phase space, it sometimes is called a, that's a bit confusing. It's, if it does not depend on phase space, it's called a closed algebra. If it does, it's called an open algebra. It's a bit confusing notation. And so in our, with our choice of constraints, I told them it's a simple choice. So the flatness constraints and the Gauss constraints actually have a closed algebra. And the diffeomorphisms constraints have an open algebra. And this is actually necessarily the case because we will see that the constraint algebra actually just reproduces the algebra of the geometric flow which the constraints produce. And so one can show that diffeomorphisms basically would always, should always lead to kind of a state-dependent algebra. Here it basically means that what you get here is depends on your phase space variables, so you can interpret it as a state-dependent, state dependence on your Lagrange multipliers. So that basically needs to be checked for consistency of time evolution, and later we will see that one has also to check that for the consistency of quantum dynamics. And so now we need to remember what is actually the Gauss constraint and some formulas. And so maybe you can guess what you should get for the Gauss constraint algebra. So this was a Gauss constraint. And then we defined basically the smeared Gauss constraint as the integrated Gauss constraint with the parameter lambda j. And on Friday, we also figured out what the smeared Gauss constraint does on the fundamental variables. And so in principle, let me just sketch you how you would compute the constraint algebra. It's one of these exercises which come up from time to time and stuff one would have to do. So there are actually many ways to compute these things. But we can do one shortcut. So basically, one way, which would be just kind of the boring way, is to take really these expressions and apply the Poisson brackets to the basic variables and collect all terms and try around with integration by parts and so on, and find all kind of try all kinds of ways that can take a bit. That was yesterday. Okay, what could we use from Friday to find this? So on Friday, we figured out what is the action of a constraint gamma lambda prime on some basic variables E and A. So I already wrote here that we basically just G lambda prime. So we don't need to do this calculation again. We just apply what we know of the Poisson bracket of G lambda prime with E and A. And so, yeah, basically, I wrote that already in the right way. So here I did an integration by parts. So I have just an E. I have an A here, and I have an E here. And this was acting by rotations. So I get an epsilon E something here. I get an epsilon E something here. And A was a gauge. Is a gauge connection, so I would get a derivative of A plus an epsilon EA term. So I get a number of terms, which of course won't fit here. So let's write it here. So this is just the gauge transformation acting on the first flux. I just get this rotated flux, infinitesimally rotated flux. the number prime, and an index missing. Okay, I have to figure out here what the index is. So the indices don't, So this is probably a key. So this is the transformation. So this is a Gauss constraint acting on the connection A, and we get a derivative of the gauge parameter plus this term, which is a epsilon A with a gauge parameter, and the E is basically from left over, and then by Leibniz rule, there's the other term. Yeah, the connection is left alone. And the Gauss constraints just act on the flux again, and you get epsilon times E. basically, that's what you have to now to consider again and to massage even more. And what you expect is that in the end, what you want to have is that it reproduces the algebra of the transformations the Gauss constraints produce. And we told, you know, we figured out that the Gauss constraints produce rotations. So what do you expect? Commutator of two rotations. Infinitesimal once. Gives you a rotation. So what you want to have is something which is, again, a Gauss constraint. So you basically try to kill all terms which are annoying you and keep you from writing it as a Gauss constraint again. And if it's just, again, a Gauss constraint, you also expect that you can rewrite this in something without any derivatives on lambda. So what you do is you look at these derivatives with lambda terms. And so in fact, you all terms together give you indeed the Gauss constraint. So here basically you would have to use the formula, which I hope is correct. We should check. And in fact, these things summarize again to an epsilon. And after some of this index gymnastics, you will be left with this expression, which just includes the local gauge parameter lambda L. Too many brackets here. And another L prime. And it gives you epsilon JML with these two gauge parameters, lambda and lambda prime. And in the middle here, you have the Gauss constraint. So in fact, you find the smearing of the Gauss constraint now with a parameter, which is given by the stuff in the yellow box. And when epsilon appears, in effect, you should recognize that as having something to do with the rotation Lie algebra. Because if you would understand these lambdas, as a Lie algebra elements, where Tj would be the generators of the Lie algebra, and this is a Lie algebra of SO3. And as structure constants, it actually has exactly the epsilons, then you would basically find that this Lie algebra thing would be given by an epsilon prime times a Lie algebra element again. It's a Lie algebra generator. And so we see that the Gauss constraint, in fact, the Poisson brackets reproduce the Lie algebra of the rotation group and, in fact, give you a representation of the representation group, which formally we can write as the Poisson brackets of two Gauss constraints give you the Gauss constraint of the commutator of the corresponding Lie algebra elements. Depending on your definitions of minus signs and so on, you might encounter sometimes a sign which you can also absorb into changing here the order of the entries. And so in any case, this tells you that this is either kind of a representation of your Lie algebra or kind of representation with opposite order of your Lie algebra. And that's one part of the calculations one would have to do. And shows you that, in fact, the Gauss constraints give you a consistent algebra. And so we had also other constraints. We had the flatness constraints. So So what do you expect for the algebra of the flatness constraints? Sorry? Yeah, it will be close. It will be, maybe it's even simpler. Yeah. So flatness constraints. For the one part, we figured out they give you these translations, which was a bit confusing because it's not translations in space-time, but they just translate the Lie algebra vectors, these fluxes. But in any case, translations is something which is abelian. And so maybe you would expect some abelian symmetry. Moreover, if you look at the Gauss the flatness constraints, they depend only on the connection. And so if you Poisson commute, this is, I mean, the connections just Poisson commute, so you would find that this gives you indeed zero. And that makes this formulation of 3D gravity so simple because the flatness constraints are really the ones which define your 3D gravity. The Gauss constraints, you have them also in Young-Mills, so you would find the same algebra. And here, in addition, the flatness constraint just give you an abelian algebra. So abelian is also always much simpler to impose than anything else. And and then there would be one left, which would be flatness with Gauss constraint, or Gauss constraint with flatness. And it's a bit easier to consider, I mean, leads to the same result, but it's easier to consider what does the Gauss constraint do with the flatness constraint. And so you can compute that again. Or you could do a physics argument which somehow rests on a belief, namely the belief that you constructed F such that it is indeed gauge covariant, and that the Gauss constraint should indeed just act as a rotation on this curvature, which just has one index, so it would just rotate this as a vector. And so with this kind of physics argument, you would get just the action of the Gauss constraint with lambda as rotating n. And that is given by the commutator of lambda with n, because it just gives you an epsilon again. And you would get this algebra. Again, in principle, you can always compute them explicitly. But here you could also apply this argument in the same way. And that's actually how you could also make this argument with a Gauss constraint, because also the Gauss constraint has one index. And so you would say another Gauss constraint would just rotate this Gauss constraint. Okay. So we found this algebra, and that basically is a simple version. I think in case I find you get the script, there will be also an additional section on actually the constraints in the case of diffeomorphism symmetry. And in this case, you will have actually an open algebra, and these parameters will depend on phase space. And that's in a much more complicated case, because in quantum theory, there's questions of algebra ordering and so on. So basically, what does it mean in the phase space picture? or actually four gauge systems. So even if so gauge systems, just some notation. Gauge systems give you a special kind of constraint systems. And the constraints which we consider here are all so-called first-class constraints. And first-class constraints are exactly those constraint systems which satisfy this property that if you have a finite index and if you have two constraints, then they satisfy an algebra which algebra constants Fijk. However, these constants can be actually in principle phase space dependent. And so these are called first class systems. And so as you can guess, there's also second class systems, and then there are mixed class systems, and so on. And we will here consider just first class systems. And gauge symmetries are basically always connected to a system of constraints, which is first class. You could have even additional constraints, and they might be anything. And then the question is if every first class system is actually a gauge system, and kind of there are counterexamples which I don't think really are of any physical relevance. And there's a Dirac conjecture saying that it's indeed the case. But okay. So in general, to summarize, we have these constraints. And so initial values would have to satisfy these constraints, which mean that they have to be, now I have to draw on the constraint hypersurface. So this is a higher dimensional space. And so here you have a constraint hypersurface or constraint surface. In your phase space, and so then we have said that every constraint itself generates a flow. So we can consider basically any point, for instance, on this constraint hypersurface. And can consider what happens with this point under the flow. And so which property does this flow satisfy? So because of this property, the flow remains on the constraint hypersurface, because this, if you take this as, for instance, C I dot, the time evolution of the constraint under another constraint, you see that this is a combination of constraints. So on the surface where this is zero, it remains zero. And so in fact, you get orbits which are generated by the constraints. And so if you assume you have to put an additional assumption, which is that the constraints are independent, and so that means that they're not only independent as equations, but also that the gradient of these constraints is independent. But in effect, it means that if you have n constraints and they are independent, So then every constraint will generate you a flow in a different direction. And so your orbits are actually n-dimensional. Okay, so we have a constrained hypersurface. Now let's say, you know. So if your phase space is 2π dimensional, 2π dimensional, then, and you have n constraints, and this constrained surface is 2π minus n dimensional. And you have this n-dimensional orbits, and of course, this is a very nice picture, which never holds globally in this form. So locally, you can always kind of choose the basis of constraints so that it looks like this, meaning it looks like a higher dimensional version of this, and everything is straight and gives you indeed something where you could say I can even take the constraints as coordinates in my phase space. So in any case, so now we would have, we say that the useful part of our phase space is actually this constrained hypersurface. This is 2π minus n dimensional, which could be even odd. If you remember what symplectic structure is about, it would mean that you have certain difficulties if it's odd to put a symplectic structure on the phase space. However, there's also this other point that we indeed have these n-dimensional orbits. And we say if this comes from gauge transformations, then we should actually identify points on the same orbit to the same state. And in fact, what I'm telling you, what I'm not going to explain is that if you would take kind of the symplectic structure which is on the big phase space and you would restrict it to your constrained hypersurface, then what you will find is that this symplectic structure restricted to the constrained hypersurface, it has null directions. And the null directions come are indeed the orbits. And you can imagine that the null directions are basically directions which don't have any conjugated direction in the constrained hypersurface. And the conjugated directions in the constrained hypersurface are exactly the constraints. And so in fact, the null directions of the symplectic structure are again the orbits. We will actually reduce outer orbits in the sense of one could consider the quotient space, and this will have a well-defined symplectic structure. So in this nice situation, what you could do is to say, I find a gauge fixing. And actually, which would mean gauge fixing that you choose another another n functions Tj and you would consider just actually the hypersurface, which now is given by these constraints and these constraints. And so in fact, what you want to have is if you would use it, that the determinant of these gauge fixings with the constraint is always non-zero, so that means that these age fixings are maximally kind of not first class with respect to the constraints. And that would tell you that locally you could always choose the coordinate system of your phase space so that these things could be used as coordinates on your phase space. And so you would consider just phase space points which satisfy the constraints and the stage fixing conditions. And that would give you the reduced phase space. And what we have done here with gauge fixing is to select one representative from each gauge orbit that you put into your gauge reduced phase space. More abstractly, what you have done is that you quotient out your constrained hypersurface by the gauge orbits. And so there are these different viewpoints. The point is that it's always hard to find, I mean, it's not always hard because you can write simple systems where it's quite easy. But in interesting physical systems, typically it's very hard to find such conditions. So for that, this is always satisfied and is simple enough to be practical. And practical means, for instance, something that the final system should, for instance, allow a local formulation, and then this doesn't even happen for Young-Mills. And in fact, it can happen that the orbits are here have you know, that you don't have a regular system, which means that the constraints are not always independent, not on all phase space points. And what you have then is that the orbits are not always the same dimension. And so what you get is that your reduced gauge phase space, which you would define by constrained hypersurface modded out by the gauge orbits, is actually not even a manifold, because if this happens, it's called an orbifold. And then things get a bit harder. And so in this case, however, you can still basically work with this system, with the unreduced phase space, and it gives you still a manifold. You have still a well-defined symplectic structure and so on. And so in field systems, of course, all things happen. So it's neither, especially in general relativity, all these things happen for sure. Already for a gauge, for something like the gauge symmetry, like rotations, as you know, rotations, they would act on a trivial point. The rotation group can have different orbits. And can reduce to just one point on like the zero triads. And a priori, we have not disallowed the zero triads. Okay. So on this reduced phase space, we would have a symplectic structure, and we could act with that. But the question is, what happens if this is too complicated a procedure and you have to work with unreduced phase space, which we are actually going to do, because in general relativity, obtaining the reduced phase space would mean that you get a one-to-one map to solutions, and that would mean you completely have solved the system and would make all numerical relativists completely jobless. So it's the subject for a psi essay. So it's somehow a bit unlikely that this will happen in the next 3 months. However, the reduced phase space is one strategy which is applicable to 3D gravity, at least in vacuum. or with some point particles, because in these cases the solutions are kind of have a finite dimension space, and that's why it's topological fields theory. And 3D gravity is so popular because you can actually do things. So let's go. But in case you have to work with an unreduced phase space, you nevertheless want to have a notion of a kind of physical observables. So that's a bit confusing because different people call these things differently. So it would mean that these are in particular things which don't depend on your choice of gauge. And that means that they don't depend on the choice of orbit here, or on point in the orbit here. It will only depend on the choice of orbit. So they can differ in this direction, but should not differ in this direction. And so physically it means that, for instance, if you change your gauge fixings here, it should give you always the same solution. In the case of gravity, it would mean that all these observables give you the same number for anything which is the same solution, and also for different slicings of the same solution. And for different slicings of the same solution is something in time evolution, so it would be actually something constant in time. So gauge-independent variables have to be constant in this direction. And so what does it mean? So this is an observable. You can express that again in Poisson brackets. And basically it's the same condition as here. Something should be invariant under the flow generated by the constraints. So this should be zero, but again, we only are interested in the constrained hypersurface. So in fact, it just needs to be equal zero, weakly equal zero. And this is meant this equation needs to be satisfied on the constrained hypersurface. Which again means that if you're smooth enough, you can always express this as some other combination of constraints. And so that defines a Dirac observable.
You want your Dirac observable to be of any type? It could be a scalar, a vector field, or
can be anything. But of course, if you have a vector field, then these usually transform under diffeomorphisms in some way, and so you will have a hard time putting it into a Dirac observable. And a scalar itself is something in gravity. Scalar itself is something which will also not be Dirac observable because it definitely transforms somehow under diffeomorphisms. It's actually defined to transform in some way. So in fact, in gravity, 4D gravity, 3D gravity, it's also the same thing. 4D gravity, there's these things to scare people. You can ask Okay, how many Dirac observables do we know as functions on phase space? And so you could say none explicitly. And that holds for compact manifolds, for compact spatial manifolds. And 10 for asymptotically flat. And I say explicitly because the, in principle, you know, there's an understanding what Dirac observables are. And 10 for asymptotically flat, this is some interesting stuff which depends on discussing very carefully the boundary conditions. These 10 observables correspond to the Poincaré charges of Poincaré symmetries, which you define at infinity. And so these correspond actually to Hamiltonian constraints and diffeomorphism constraints with constant flux or constant lapse and constant shift parameters. So they don't vanish at infinity. And so you get a time evolution at infinity. And you have also a symmetry with respect to constant kind of time evolution. And that gives you actually something like the so-called ADM mass and an ADM angular momentum for gravity. So in fact, there's a theorem. Somebody called Charles Torr or Torrey. that Dirac observables have to be non-local. And that means they have to be integrals of quantities which even might contain infinitely many spatial derivatives. So in the last 2 minutes, let me just tell you what it all means. So that's the scary part. And in fact, we said we have to do a gauge fixing here, and that would give us a reduced phase space. And this reduced phase space would, in fact, correspond to also prescribing uniquely a slicing in the space-time. So if you just stay in this reduced phase space, you actually don't get any time evolution. So in fact, if I say time evolution is part of the gauge transformations, then this condition tells me all the Dirac observables have to be constant in time. And that was called like sometimes frozen time formalism. And people got scared. They say, oh, there's no time evolution. It's a bad thing. But all what you have done is that actually you have rewritten your system into a one-to-one map between solutions and initial data. And then you have to define that different times in your solution space corresponds to the same state. And so, in fact, you know, it's not so mysterious what happens. But you find part of the literature puts it still quite this very mysterious way. However, what you can do, you can actually allow for, say, if you allow for one parameter choice of gauge fixings. So now, you know, say all your gauge fixings just depend on one parameter, and you have chosen this family of gauge fixings now, such that you know, the simplest form could be that Tj is some Tj0 minus tau. That in fact, changing your gauge fixing here with the parameter tau corresponds to really something like a time evolution in nice systems. And it would correspond to a nice evolution if, in fact, Pj is something what you would call a Hamiltonian, if that at least one T0, which gives you one under a combination of constraints which you have defined as Hamiltonian. So then you would say, okay, this could be a nice time parameter. Of course, in practice, it's usually difficult to find this, but assume you find that, then in fact you can regain exactly what you mean under time evolution. So you would still you can construct Dirac observables, which would give you the value of phase space functions restricted to this gauge fixing, and if this gauge fixing moves, also the observables will change, but they will change in this parameter tau. So it just means that you need to decide what is your time evolution, and you decide that by your choice of gauge fixing, and you decide what is your parameter, what is your time parameter, and here you can choose for one global time parameter, or you can construct whatever notion of time you want, like with 5 time parameters, and you can also reconstruct the time evolution. This time evolution will be, however, with respect to these taus, and you can make your observables tau dependent. Nevertheless, formally, they will be always Dirac observables. And so that is called kind of partial complete observables. And so it's not so mysterious. It just, it's hard to compute them explicitly, but in practice, you can find them. And so to answer your question, what you would have to do is to define gauge fixings like other vector fields. And you would have to express your second vector field, which you are really interested in the frame given by the other vector fields. And this would give you a complicated way of finding something which is invariant under rotations, because it would be just some combination of scalar products between these two vector fields. And you have a chance to get Dirac observables after solving the evolution and so on. Okay, so that would be like a physical frame. So that means you would have always to find first field observables which you use as a frame and as clocks and rods to express your physical quantities in. And there's a deep fact about general relativity, and that's that there are no perfect clocks. Okay, thank you.